Last week, as a continuation of our study in Leviticus, we discussed the abrogation of sacrificial offerings, and that, of course, followed a deeper discussion on the specific regulations surrounding those sacrifices. This week, we jump into the details of a new abrogated portion of the law, dietary cleanliness. Today, we'll be examining Leviticus chapter 11, whose material is essentially repeated in Deuteronomy 14, along with several other passages from the law, to get an overview of the do's and don'ts of Israeli eating under the Old Covenant. And of course, I'll make it clear to you up front, you don't have to keep these dietary restrictions today. They served a purpose in their time, but that time has passed. So while this is interesting and valuable to learn, it is of no meaningful, practical effect in modern Christian life. We won't be focusing on the abrogation or the purposes of the dietary restrictions today, however, but we'll only be focusing on describing the restrictions themselves. In studying the passages, we will find that the restrictions are really not overly complicated. There is a list of animals, some of which are clean for eating and some of which are not. There are restrictions on eating things found dead. There is a restriction against boiling a goat kid in its mother's milk. So when you get right down to the fundamentals, these dietary restrictions aren't particularly complicated. Your passage for consideration is Leviticus 11, and so if you haven't yet read it, I recommend that you pause and do so now. Now, before we get on to the passage, it bears noting that this is not the first mention of clean and unclean animals. In Genesis 7, Noah was commanded to bring animals with him into the ark. Specifically, he was commanded to bring two of each kind, but he was commanded to bring seven pairs of each kind of clean animal. Evidently, he was required to bring these for the purposes of making sacrifices, because at the time, as we have mentioned previously, mankind was vegetarian, meat not being given to man for food until after the flood. And of course, we see Noah making an animal sacrifice after the flood. Sacrifices were made in other places in Genesis, like the sacrifice of Abel or the sacrifice of Abraham up on the mountain. And in those instances, they sacrificed animals from the flock, animals which we know to be clean. So evidently God had given his people word about which animals were clean for sacrifices as far back as the fall itself. When men were granted the right to eat meat, it was those sacrificial animals which could be eaten, and indeed the clean animals and the sacrificial animals coincide. So clean and unclean predated this passage, but this passage is the earliest extant record of the precise rules. With that, we're on to the passage. As is stated in Leviticus 11, verses 1 through 2, this list of dietary restrictions is an edict from God, delivered through Moses, and directed to all the people. Not just the Levites were required to keep the dietary restrictions. All Israel was required to do so. The first dietary restriction in this passage, listed in verses 3 through 7 and reiterated in Deuteronomy 14, 3 through 8, describes which land animals may or may not be eaten. And there are two restrictions. First, the animal must have a parted hoof, as in, not a normal foot with soft pads and toes, nor a full foot hoof like that of a horse. So that would allow for cows, oxen, sheep, deer, giraffes, goats, buffalo, antelopes, elk, moose, pigs, and so forth. Of course, as the passage notes, we would have to eliminate the pigs from that list, because they don't meet the second criterion. The clean animal is one which will chew the cud. Now, for those who may not be up and up on their animal digestive systems, there is a class of animals which chew and swallow their food, only to regurgitate that food in a partially digested state for more chewing. That regurgitated food is called cud, and the animal chewing it is an animal which chews the cud. Pigs aren't one of those animals. One animal which does chew the cud is the camel. But we can't add that to our list because it doesn't have a parted hoof. It has two big toes with big toenails, and they aren't quite a hoof, so unclean it is. The passage also lists a few other animals which might cause some confusion, those being the hare or rabbit and the rock badger or hyrax, a small mammal which looks a bit like a rabbit without the characteristic long ears. The passage notes in verses 5 and 6 that these creatures are unclean because despite, quote, chewing the cud, they don't part the hoof. And of course, it is true that these animals have soft, padded feet. It is, however, not correct that these animals chew the cud. For this reason, these verses are a go-to for opponents of the Bible, who claim that it can't be trusted because it contains incorrect information about the digestion of these two small mammals. So what's going on here? Well, my first instinct is to say that this is not intended as a zoology text. The point isn't to describe animal digestive systems. The point is to distinguish between clean and unclean. In that regard, the text is factually correct. A rabbit and a hyrax are, in fact, unclean. The passage looks at these animals from the perspective of its audience. It says, "This might look clean to you. You might think, oh look, it's chewing cud. Well, don't be deceived. It isn't clean." So, when I read this passage, it doesn't look wrong to me. It's pointing out a confusion that a person might have as a confusion, not a fact. We also have to bear in mind that this was written for a people who didn't have the kind of in-depth knowledge of an animal's inner workings that we have today. Rabbits and hyraxes are recognizable for their chewing motions. It might look to a person who knows no better that they are chewing cud, but that motion alone doesn't make them clean, and that's the point. Furthermore, it has been argued, and we cite as our source Dr. Tommy Mitchell of Answers in Genesis, see a link in the library, that rabbits do, in fact, chew cud. By this argument, the word cud is more broadly defined to include re-ingesting not only regurgitation, but also feces. So, the cow chews its cud by puking it up, but the rabbit chews its cud by pooping it out. And yes, rabbits do eat their own poo. Dr. Mitchell concludes, rabbits re-ingest partially digested foods, as do modern ruminants. So, either way you'd like to slice it, there's no contradiction here. And of course, we can see why a cud-chewer of the first kind might be considered clean, while a cud-chewer of the second kind wouldn't, because it's pretty gross to eat poop. Immediately thereafter, verses 9 through 12 describe water-dwelling creatures that can be eaten, and the distinction is pretty straightforward. Any fish can be eaten, a fish being a thing with fins and scales, but no other water-dwelling creature can be, so that means no lobsters, crabs, shrimp, etc. And of course, those restrictions on water creatures find a repetition in Deuteronomy 14 at verses 9 through 10. Following land creatures and water creatures, we have restrictions regarding air-dwelling creatures, mostly birds, in Leviticus 11:13-19 and Deuteronomy 14:11-20. Now, before we dig into these, I think it is worth noting that there is not an absolute consensus on exactly which birds are described here, and different translations have listed different birds. So, for example, the ESV lists the ostrich, which other translations do not. The NIV and King James both have an owl at this slot. The NIV lists the osprey, where the ESV lists the carrion vulture, and the King James lists the gear eagle. Meanwhile, the King James includes the cuckoo, spelled with a W at the end in place of the second O, as well as the swan and the pelican, where the NIV and ESV have different birds named. So, to make a long story short, I'm not sure that we even have a clear understanding of exactly which birds were intended here. The good news, though, is that it doesn't matter because we don't have to observe the dietary restrictions. And even if we did, chicken isn't on the list, and that's most of what people eat when they're eating birds anyway. So, for all practical purposes, it would be a moot point. It seems to me that the distinction separating these unclean birds from the others is their diet. The list of restricted animals on this list are mostly birds of prey, owls, hawks, herons, and so forth, and also scavengers, like vultures and the raven. It is possible that the intent of this rule is to avoid eating creatures which may have picked up diseases from decaying animals or swarming creatures. It may also have been a matter of practicality. These animals would be more expensive to farm. Or perhaps it is simply a matter of function. Some animals were designed to be eaten, while others were designed to clean up the dead things and to keep the vermin in check. And of course, there's a little thorn in everyone's side with the bat. This is another of those inclusions that makes atheists go wild. "Wow," they say, "look at how dumb the Bible is. The Christians think that bats are birds." And that's just downright silly. Everyone knows what a bird looks like. They've got beaks and feathers. Of course, the reason that we regard birds in that way is because we have chosen to classify them that way. The ancients, however, classified their creatures by where and how they lived. As we've seen, we covered large land animals, then sea animals, and now air animals. The scriptures clearly intend that this is a list of flying creatures, not a list of birds, as we define the word today. So in this context, yes, a bat is indeed a bird. After the air-dwelling creatures, Leviticus departs from Deuteronomy in that Leviticus gives additional instructions concerning swarming creatures, the little land-dwelling or mixed-dwelling things that generally stick close to the ground. Among those, there is only one clean classification of things: insects with wings and jointed legs for hopping, like grasshoppers, locusts, katydids, and crickets. We note that the passage describes these as being among the creatures that go on all fours. This is not inaccurate, because it is not to be taken as a literal counting of feet. These swarming creatures are part of a class of creatures which walk with their bodies parallel to the ground and with four legs down. The descriptor "on all fours" describes that group in general, but doesn't literally count feet. Now, Deuteronomy evidently leaves the discussion out as being somewhat extraneous, because, with the minor exception of the cricket-like things, none of the swarming things are clean. It follows, then, that they weren't mentioned in the list of clean land-dwelling animals above, and they aren't clean, and there's no compelling need to mention them twice. That said, in the interest of being thorough, Leviticus makes the matter especially clear. So, from Leviticus 11:29-45, we have a list of unclean animals, including lizards, rats, mice, snakes, spiders, and other bugs, etc. Little swarming things don't have parted hooves and chewed cud, or jointed hopping legs, so they're unclean. Unlike other unclean animals, simply touching them makes a person unclean. If you touch them, you become unclean for the day, and you have to wash your clothes. These swarming things, which are small enough to sneak into your residence, might also touch some of the things that you own, and by doing so would make those things unclean. In Leviticus 11:32-38, we have instructions on how to clean those things. In general, the requirement was to clean those things by washing them with water. If it was a food and it got bugs into it, it had to be thrown away. And vessels made of earth, like clay pots or stoves, could not be cleaned out and had to be smashed. The next dietary rule in Leviticus was actually sandwiched into the middle of the rules about swarming things, and that rule prohibits the eating of an animal which dies out in the field. We see that command reiterated in Deuteronomy 14:21, and we passed it before in Exodus 22:31. We also mentioned this rule in our message, Rules for Priests, on October 21, 2018. The rule here is pretty simple. If it dies on its own, it was probably sick. Don't eat it, and don't touch it. This also extends to animals which were attacked and killed by wild animals. It could have a disease. Don't eat it. In fact, if you even touch an animal like that, you're unclean. You can't attend the temple until the next day, and you need to wash your clothes. Now, perhaps the most curious part of the dietary law is listed at the very end of Deuteronomy 14:21, where there is an oddly specific restriction against boiling a baby goat in its mother's milk. Well, you know what they say, if it had to be banned, someone must have tried it, but it's obscure enough that I must admit, apart from reading about it here, it would probably never have crossed my mind. The command must have been important, though, because it is also listed in two other places, Exodus 23:19 and Exodus 34:26, with the same odd specificity. Now, I want to be as clear as I can about this weird little law. It prohibits one of two very narrow things. It could, in the first case, refer to the cooking of a goat, and not just any goat, but a young goat, and it would refer to cooking that goat in a very specific way, not by mixing it with milk, but by boiling it in milk, and not just any milk, but its own mother's milk. Does it prohibit, then, boiling a cow in its mother's milk? Well, not so far as I can tell. Does it prohibit eating a goat while drinking its mother's milk? Nope. Does it even prohibit boiling a baby goat in the milk of some other unrelated goat? No. It prohibits one thing, and one thing only: boiling a young goat in its own mother's milk. The other possibility is that this passage prohibits the boiling of a goat which is still in its mother's milk, as in a goat which is still young enough to suckle. In that case, this prohibits boiling a baby goat and has nothing to do with a human cooking or consuming milk at all. And of course, I make a point of that because there is a stark contrast between what the scripture actually says and how the Jews have interpreted it. Where the scripture is very specific and narrow, the Jewish application is very broad, and it basically bars any contact between milk and meat whatsoever, regardless of whether or not a goat is involved, including any contact between the utensils used to prepare the foods, because any contact whatsoever could possibly transfer one particle of meat to touching one particle of milk. So they end up with some really weird outcomes, in which strict Jews will have a rule barring them from drinking milk for several hours after eating meat, because there might be a microscopic meat particle left over in the mouth, which might accidentally make contact with a drop of milk. Never mind that the restriction that we just read says nothing about eating or combining meat and milk at all. You'll find Jews who even go so far as to have two refrigerators, one to keep milk and another to keep meat, because for whatever reason, they think this command bans them from having the packaging from a meat product come into contact with the packaging from a milk product. They'll keep color-coded dishes, one for meat and one for milk, and then they'll run two loads of dishes through the dishwasher at separate times, or even get two dishwashers, so that they can be certain that no meat particles happen to touch any milk particles in the washing process. With standards that broad and that strict, I'm forced to wonder why Jews even drink milk at all, seeing that their own stomachs are made from meat and that the two will eventually touch. And goodness, we might guess that all of their infants will starve, since mother's milk comes from a breast made of flesh. Now, I don't want to verbally berate Jews for their practice here. I can appreciate the fact that they're willing to go to such an extreme to do what they perceive to be the right thing. However, I think that anyone has to admit that this milk and meat practice is downright silly, and especially since the passages in question say nothing at all about mixing milk and meat to begin with. And goodness, you're never more glad to be a Christian than when you realize that we dodged having to deal with all that hassle. And I know, we're not really delving into the purposes of dietary restrictions here, but since this one is so bizarre, I think we're forced to ask why it was ever a rule at all. I mean, doesn't this just seem silly and weird? This is one of those principles that atheists just have a field day with. Hey, stupid Christians, if you believe the Bible, don't you think it's evil to boil goats in milk? Well, odd as it may seem, there have been a few proposed answers as to why this was done at all. In the first place, it is clear in the scriptures that one of the purposes of the dietary restrictions is to separate God's people from the culture around them. See Leviticus 20:25-26 for that, and expect me to talk about it more next week. So, when I read this oddly specific prohibition, I presume that it must have been a common act among the Canaanites, which is associated with something particularly bad. So it seems not at all unlikely to me that boiling a kid in its mother's milk was some sort of pagan ritual which Israel was to avoid imitating. Others have suggested that there is something inherently perverse or inhumane about the practice. It is suggested, for example, that it is an affront to the natural relationship between mother and child, a jarring juxtaposition of life and death, to use the milk which the mother produced to give life to her new kid, to take the life of that kid. Personally, I find that argument to be particularly emotional, symbolic, and unsupported by any other text. It might also be that this prohibition against boiling a young goat, one which is still not weaned, was intended as a reminder that the firstborn animal of the flock was to be given as an offering. See, for example, Exodus 34:19. Particularly, both passages in Exodus have this command about the kid paired with a command about the firstfruits offering, and in Exodus 22:30, we read that such firstfruits offerings were made on the eighth day, while the goat was surely still suckling. So, I know we haven't gotten to discuss the firstfruits offering yet, but it's possible this weird verse is just a reminder to offer the firstborn goat rather than boiling him and eating him. Now, there are problems with that. Why does it prohibit the boiling of all young goats and not just the firstborn? Why does it qualify the goat's age by suckling and not by the number of days it has been alive? Hard to say, I guess. The point, though, is this. The command against boiling a kid in its mother's milk isn't just some unreasonable, bizarre thing. It's there for a sensible reason, whether or not we've guessed what that reason is, and we've got some possible explanations. So whatever the reason, and whatever the exact meaning, on inspection, this command is maybe not quite as weird as it seemed in the beginning. And the best news about it is that we don't really need to worry with it. Christians don't have to concern themselves with these dietary restrictions, and particularly, we don't have to worry about the over-the-top modern Jewish interpretation of things. So before we conclude, I want to note that these dietary restrictions, as they are listed in the Bible, aren't wildly unreasonable. And I want to point this out because too often the Law of Moses is viewed as being some kind of unnecessary, frivolous list of burdens which serves no purpose, but I don't think that at all when I read these laws. To the contrary, I see this as being both about respecting the purity of the sacrifices and about having a generally good and healthy dietary guideline. In fact, I would guess that you're keeping these rules, with only a few exceptions, and that despite those exceptions, you're keeping these rules the overwhelming majority of the time. So, for example, you probably recognize that there's a health benefit here. You probably don't, under any ordinary circumstances, eat swarming things like snakes or spiders or rats or bugs. You would be concerned to do so, because those animals are often poisonous or diseased or just gross. They are unclean, and generally they make for bad food. I would suppose also that if you went into a restaurant and it was infested with roaches and no one was cleaning the dishes after the roaches had been on them, you would probably not eat there. And in fact, if you're a normal person, you don't like touching dead bugs or the corpses of dead animals either. You probably don't eat dogs or cats or any other number of animals which don't chew the cud or have a parted hoof. In fact, in most cases, you would probably find it disgusting if someone did eat those animals, and you might even mock them for it. I recall, for instance, that there was a lot of political wisecracking about former President Barack Obama when he was running for office because he once ate dog as a child. And we've all heard the joke about some seedy Chinese restaurant. It came into town, and the stray cat problem was mysteriously solved. Maybe this is just historical and cultural. You think eating cats and dogs is gross because you've been in a culture which has some level of connection to this passage. Or maybe you think that because there's actually something innately gross about eating some of these animals, and you naturally recognize that. Perhaps there is a natural and good reason to distinguish between an animal which is a predator or a scavenger, as most of the unclean animals are, and the herbivores, because herbivores are less likely to pick up some weird disease. When was the last time that you saw a bat and thought, that looks like good eating? Probably never. You know what I think when I see a bat or any other number of wild predatory animals? I think, that thing is going to bite me and give me rabies. These kinds of animals generally don't make for good food. And when was the last time that you were riding down the highway and thought, oh look, a dead animal. It's been lying there for a while. I think I'll pick it up and eat it. Odds are good that you've never done that. And you know why you haven't. It's unclean and it could make you sick. While you might eat things like lobster and shrimp, you probably also recognize that allergic reactions to those foods are common, so much so that you sometimes can't even eat them in the same room as someone who has an allergy to them. It makes general sense to me that a food group which commonly causes potentially fatal allergic reactions be banned. And by the way, there are only a few things out there in the sea that you would make an exception for. I'd suppose that you don't eat 90% of the unclean sea creatures because they're inedible or poisonous. You probably also don't eat shellfish as a dietary staple even if you aren't allergic, because these animals tend to be more expensive to produce than the clean animals that we've described. So we recognize that there is a general economic sensibility here. I would speculate that the clean animals provide the best bang for your buck. And I'm speculating here, but my supposition is that they provide the best nutrition at the lowest cost to maintain, and that food is the best purpose for the creatures. Have you ever eaten a horse? Well, probably not. Why not? Well, maybe it's just cultural, but more likely it's economical. Your ancestors would have been stupid to eat a horse, because a horse was so useful for travel and domestic work, not nearly as well suited for eating as a cow. There's a financial reason that one is good for eating and the other is good for plowing. The same goes for something like a deer. It has no real purpose aside from being food. Seeing that it can't be used for anything better, well, you might as well eat it. This might also be the reason for the goat command. If you raised goats, you would probably wait for them to grow out of their mother's milk before killing them and eating them, because it would be a waste, uneconomical, to eat them so small and before they've had an opportunity to breed. If you want a growing herd and a full belly, wait until the creature gets a little older before you kill it. So while we might not be forced to keep these rules today, my guess is that we do generally keep them because they're what makes sense. Odds are good that you don't eat most of the unclean animals listed here, and the majority of all the meals you eat just so happen to be kosher. With only a few exceptions, primarily pork and a handful of seafoods, or maybe the occasional wild game supper, my guess is that you're following these guidelines whether or not you think you have a religious obligation to do so. And that leads me to the conclusion that this is, whatever the reason may be, a good general guideline for healthy dietary habits. God didn't give his people junk rules to keep just for the sake of hassling them with things. He gave them rules which make sense and which existed for the sake of their own general well-being. We might quibble with the general simple-to-follow guideline by making a few exceptions, but most of the time, this adds up, and you follow it. And for those who think that God's laws regarding food were onerous or overly burdensome, I recommend that you go talk with your local health inspector about all the rules your local restaurants have to follow to be allowed to serve food in your area. I can guarantee you that the list doesn't fit on 2 pages. So then, in conclusion, those are the dietary restrictions. As a brief overview, they are: only eat livestock that parts the hoof and chews the cud. Only eat seafood with fins and scales. Only eat birds which aren't birds of prey or scavenger birds. If you've got to eat bugs, only eat the cricket types. Don't eat things that you find dead. Don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. Keep your dishes and other food articles clean. While we aren't required to keep those rules, in general, you probably do, because it's a sensible set of rules. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.